Yeah, this morning we're going to pick up kind of where we left off, but our main lesson today is Revelation chapter 13. But we're going to talk a little bit about Revelation 12, as we always do before we start. And we're going to try to set up Revelation 13 by reading the last sentence of Revelation 12. Actually, if you look at your Bible, you may notice that Revelation 13:1 is listed in the last part of Revelation 12. And that's because, as you know, or as you may not remember, but I'll tell you, all of the biblical record is not written in chapters and verses. All of those were done by the people that did the translation. And so the chapters are thoughts, the verses are thoughts within the chapters. Actually, chapter 13:1, verse 13:1 actually goes better with chapter 12 than it does 13. So that's why you see it. It's called 13:1, so there's no problem if somebody says, "What's Revelation 13:1?" and you look in your Bible and it's not there. They've just scooted it up under Revelation 12 in many of the translations, just because that's where it fits. It's actually a long verse, and the first part of it fits with 12. Second part of it fits with chapter 13. But chapter 12, if you recall, was kind of an interesting chapter. It was a chapter where we get introduced to the panorama of some of the some of the characters that are going to be around during the end times, and we see a couple of things that are pretty apparent. We need to memorize some of the characters, and we see someone called the woman. The woman in this case is the state of Israel, or it's Israeli people, God's covenant people. The dragon is Satan himself, and there are references to that. The woman gives birth to a child. The child is called a male child, which is a symbolism of Christ. And of course, the devil is positioned right where the woman gives birth to devour the child as quick as she can. And of course, the Lord protects the child, and the woman flees to the hills to protect her. And this all symbolizes Satan's intent on trying to kill Christianity, because without the forgiveness of sin and without the whole grace part of the equation, there's really no way we get to heaven except through faith, like they did in the Old Testament. But the faith in the Old Testament was really a belief in a coming Messiah. And so without that Messiah, a lot of that goes away. And so one of Satan's aims was to try to, you know, kill Christ. And of course, without killing him, he tries to, you know, take his witness away, tries to subvert him through some of the things that you read about in the Gospels. But this is a symbolism, and it's a symbolism for the ages. So John is looking at what's happening, and he's seeing kind of a panorama. And he sees this panorama of a woman. He sees this panorama of this dragon. And this dragon is thrown down out of heaven and takes a third of the angels with him. And so that symbolically becomes Satan and his demons, and the demons are really fallen angels. So that's where you see some of that. Now, all of that is symbolism out of the Old Testament. This is not brand new symbolism. You see it in Isaiah, you see it in Ezekiel, you see it in Daniel. All through these prophetic books in the Old Testament, you see a lot of these symbols, which John had in his mind, because John was a Jew, an Old Testament scholar, as well as a participant in the New Testament. And so we see a lot of that symbolism. And if you've got a Bible with footnotes, you can go back and read some of the text back in Daniel and Isaiah and Ezekiel and see some of the symbolism that was in John's mind. But when this dragon appears, he has heads and horns. Heads, horns, and crowns. And all of that is kind of a symbol of the Roman Empire and the empires that came before that. We talked about who those are, and we talked about the crowns being on the heads of the dragon. And all of this is kind of, you know, mystical stuff, and we don't really in depth know what it means, but I think all the interpreters have kind of settled on a common set of thoughts based on the Old Testament. And that's what I'm going to share with you today. And so we see the crowns of power on the heads of Satan, which symbolizes that Satan was in control of a lot of these ancient empires, you know, whether it's the Roman Empire or whether it's the, you know, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Grecian Empire, or, you know, the some of the other empires that came along and tried to take over the world. Satan was in control of those, and Babylonian Empire, and, you know, all of their interactions with Israel are documented, you know, in the Old Testament. You can see the roles they played. Certainly you can read them in secular history as well. And so chapter 12 begins there, and of course Satan doesn't have his way. He doesn't get to the baby Jesus, and the woman is allowed to flee to the hills. And all through the Old Testament and New Testament, you see promises about the hills being your salvation. And, you know, look to the hills, look to the mountains from whence comes your salvation is a common quoted verse in the Old Testament. And we see, if we're a student at all of some of the Revelation, we see where, you know, in the end times, most of the Jews fled to Petra to be protected by God. And so there's a lot of symbolism in fleeing to the mountains to get away from what's going on. And so you see that symbolism all through. And of course, a couple of other things occur. Satan, of course, tries to kill off the Christ child, but he also, there's a war that comes to place in heaven, and this is the war with Michael and the angels, and essentially that's the middle part of chapter 12, and Satan loses that battle, and he gets cast away from heaven. And we talked about Satan used to be, or is today, but at a time in the future, he'll be cast out of heaven. He'll no longer be able to accuse us in front of the Lord. And so he'll be permanently assigned to earth as his prowling domain until he gets assigned to the lake of fire. And so we see that occur, and Satan is pretty ticked off about it, and he starts taking it out on Israel. And so Israel flees, and she's given wings of eagles to fly to the mountains. And all of this has symbolism in the Old Testament. And so when he can't get to her any longer, he turns on all of the remnants of the belief in her. So he turns on the believers. He turns on the 144,000 Jews. He turns on all the people that are believers. And so, you know, he vents his wrath there. And so you begin to see a little bit of trouble there. And so you kind of move from this scene in heaven to this war in heaven that Satan loses. And then he's cast to earth. And there's kind of this beginning of a war on earth, with Satan going after all of the people that are, you know, believers. And that's kind of where we end chapter 12, except for the last, actually the first sentence in chapter 13. And I'll read that for you. I read it at the close of last one. It's kind of like verse 1a, if you will. And it says, "And the dragon stood on the shore of the sea." So all of this war happens in heaven. All this war is beginning on earth. And the devil himself is standing on the shore of the sea. Now, the shore of the sea is kind of symbolic, and we'll see that as we get into it. So let's take a look at verses 1 and 2 in chapter 13. And someone want to read chapters 1 and 2 for me? Verses 1 and 2, I'm sorry. Chapter 13. All right, I'll read it. And it says, "And I saw..." It says, "And the dragon stood on the shore of the sea, and I saw a beast coming out of the sea. He had 10 horns, 7 heads, and 10 crowns on the horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, had feet like a bear, mouth like a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority." So, picture this for a second. Satan himself is standing on the shore of the sea. The shore of the sea, and some of your translations will say upon the sand. All of this is symbolism of, as I mentioned, the Jews hated the ocean. So the sea here is probably the Mediterranean Sea. And he's standing on the sea. And all of the sand represents the world and the people that are not part of the redeemed kingdom. So he's standing there, and he looks to the sea. And out of the sea comes another beast. And this other beast is similar to the dragon. He's not a red dragon, but he's another beast of some kind. We don't know exactly what he looks like. But the word beast here is the same thing that it was before. It means Leviathan or large creature. And so that whatever that is comes out of the ocean. A lot of reasons, a lot of people try to equate ocean with something. I don't know what it means other than the ocean was kind of equated with not a good place. And so when for the Jews. And so when something came out of the ocean, they weren't real happy to see it. It usually meant trouble for them. And of course, this is the Antichrist we're looking at. But he looks similar to the dragon in that he has 10 heads. He has 10 horns, 7 heads, and 10 crowns on the horns. So if you think about Satan before, the crowns on Satan were on the heads. They weren't on the horns. Now they've moved from the heads to the horns. And you think, well, boy, that's all mystical. I don't know what that means. But it symbolizes, again, the old Roman Empire and the rebirth of the new Roman Empire, except now the Antichrist has begun to give power to this 10-nation new Roman Empire. And so, you know, all of the allegories you hear and the prophetic preachers who preach on this talk about the revived Roman Empire, and there's a million ways you can take that discussion. We're going to stick pretty close to what the biblical record is as opposed to a bunch of hypothetical about who this was and who represents that and all that. I mean, we can talk about it, you know, what people think, but the point here is the crowns have moved from Satan to these heads of state. So they are going to assume a lot of satanic power, because it says in verse 2, the beast I saw resembled a leopard, feet like a bear, mouth like a lion. And so that's sort of a replay of the same old Roman Empire being rebirthed. And the dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and authority. So the symbolism of the horns moving from the heads from the crowns moving from the heads to the horns is a movement of power. Horns represent power and authority. And so the power and authority of Satan has been given over to this 10-nation confederacy, if you will. Another thing that's a little bit, you have to kind of struggle with this, and I'll just lay it out for you, because it's the same here and it's the same with the next one we see. This beast is representative of two things. It's representative of the person we call the Antichrist, but it's also representative of the organization of the Antichrist. So it represents not only a person, but it represents an organization or an affiliation or a movement or a government or whatever you want to call it. It's something bigger than this one person. It's bigger than that. So it represents a movement. It also represents the person himself. And so, because you'll see some discussion about the movement, then you'll see other discussion about the person. So you have to understand that it's both. And we'll talk about how that can be as we get further on. Verse 3 says, one of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. And it's interesting, because if you think of the word Antichrist, anti means opposes, right? If you think of an anti-gravity machine, it's a machine that's nullifies gravity. So the Antichrist, what that phrase means is somebody that's trying to operate in parallel. If you're a football fan, you know the defenses that they'll call a shadow defense, where they have a really good player on the other team and they'll assign a linebacker to that player, and that player doesn't move without that linebacker moving with him, because he's the threat. And so wherever that player moves, regardless of what else is going on, they stay close. The Antichrist is kind of like that. The Antichrist is trying to pattern himself after Christ. And so Christ died and rose again. And it seems like this Antichrist has a head that's had a fatal wound, yet is back alive. And so, you know, that we'll see more of that as we play out. But that's trying to emulate the death and resurrection of Christ in terms of power. And so that's what that is, a wound that had been healed. Now, there's speculation as to whether Satan has the ability to raise from the dead. And I don't know all the theological underpinnings to argue that point. But most of the commentators will tell you that this this appears to be a non-fatal wound. It appears like a fatal wound, but it's not a fatal wound, and this person comes back to life, and Satan is able to bring them back to life, or this particular part of this empire. And it says, the whole world was astonished and followed the beast. Well, it's kind of interesting. You know, they weren't astonished when Jesus came back to life. Only a small group of Jews followed that. But remember, this is a time, the rapture has occurred, the Christian influence, by and large, is gone. All of the Christians are gone, except those that have come to know the Lord during the time of tribulation, called tribulation saints, and the 144,000 Jews that have been sealed by God. So the Christian influence is not very rampant. Most of the people in the world that are left are people that are not Christians. They're either apathetic to Christ, or they are hostile to Christ. They're hostile to God. And so all of the plagues, all of the things that have happened, all of the, you know, a third of the people being killed, and, you know, the water being turned to blood, and the hailstones, and the mountains moved, and the lakes rising, and all the stuff that we've seen so far, it hasn't moved anybody to speak of percentage-wise to come to the Lord. So we're in Revelation 13, by the way, if you're interested in what chapters we're in. And so all of this, you know, it's playing before a hostile audience. You know, you realize just in today's world, if you have a particular point of view of faith, and you go before a group that does not hold that point of view, you may get a hostile reception, you may get a who cares reception, but they're not going to stand up and applaud when you're done, generally speaking, with your conversation. And that's really what's happening here. So what happens is this head wound is mystifying. They're all there. You know, we have in our very souls, I believe, and you've heard a lot of people talk about it more eloquently than I can, we have this little God-shaped hole in our heart, and we try to fill it with all kinds of things. Some of us are lucky enough to have filled it with the Lord, but those that aren't fill it with other things, whether it's mystical beliefs, whether it's spiritualism, whether it's following a cult-like figure. We all try to look for somebody bigger than us that can give us things that we can sign on to and follow. And so these people, even though they've rejected God, still have that desire in their heart to follow. And so they see this thing come to pass, a time of war, a time of trouble, and they gravitate to it. And it says here, the whole world was astonished and followed the beast. And so you can begin to see, with all of the communications capability and satellites and TVs and, you know, iPods and phones with video and all the other stuff, and probably what we'll have in 10 years from now, everybody's watching. And it says they were astonished. And it says, men worshiped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast, and they also worshiped the beast and asked, who is like the beast, who can make war against him? They finally found somebody who was powerful, who could lead them, who might be able to stop all of these assaults by God, who might be able to stem the tide of judgments, because they had exhibited great power. And so they begin to follow them. And they, by worshiping the beast, which is the Antichrist, they're worshiping Satan. And, you know, through all of the empires of the world where people have declared themselves to be God, you know, whether it's the holy, the Japanese, you know, where the emperor was God himself, or whether it's, you know, some forms of Hinduism and so forth where they take on that role, or whether it is the Caesars who had you declare that they were Lord and God. People, or even in modern times, you know, kings in Europe have taken on this role of being God's chosen person, you know, to be God's spokesperson for the world. And we see that in a lot of the, you know, certainly the Middle Ages structure and Charlemagne and, you know, the battles between the popes and the archbishops of England and all of that. It was really who spoke for God. You know, it was really political. But, you know, the outer image they portrayed was who spoke for God. And so we see that as something that happens all the time. We see it in Islam today. We see this intense religious fervor where they think they speak for God and no one else speaks for God. And if you don't bow down to them, then you're killed. You're not worthy to be alive. And so, you know, this is not something that just happens in the end time. We've seen it in our history. We see it. We're watching it unfold before us today with the, you know, with the Islamic fundamentalists and radicals. And so it's not an unlikely event. It's not something that we can't understand. And so they think they're invincible. You know, who can stand up to the beast? Who can fight him? Who can make war against him? And of course, some of this is reminiscent of Old Testament verses. Exodus 15:11 talks about God being almighty and God being powerful and no one can stand against him. So a lot of this is parallel symbolism for Satan and Antichrist to parallel the Old Testament thought of the Jews regarding the Lord himself. Verse 5 says, "The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and to exercise his authority for 42 months. I guess some of this goes back to Daniel. If you go back to Daniel chapter 7, you'll see a lot of this and maybe a little greater symbolism played out. But the beast here is the Antichrist. So the Antichrist was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemy. So, but you can understand today, you hear people on television today who are certainly not the Antichrist, but you hear them uttering blasphemous words against the Lord. You know, you hear them talking about God in very profane ways. You hear them talking about the people of God in very profane ways. And so this is not new either. What we're going to see, though, is this will be on a scale that will be unbelievable. It'll be astonishing. It'll be heart-wrenching for those that believe in this end time. And so he was given a mouth to utter proud words. In other words, words where he elevates himself. You know, he's better than them. They're vermin of the earth. We're going to kill them off. And blasphemies. Now, blasphemies is kind of interesting, too, because, you know, even in Caesar times, people had to declare that Caesar was Lord and God. And so Caesar declared that. And so that was a blasphemy. And Christians, you know, went to the lions and, you know, suffered martyrdom before they would give up their faith or before they would utter the phrase that Caesar is Lord and Caesar is God. And so we see that coming back again, you know, to full circle. What the Roman Empire couldn't accomplish in its earlier days, it will have much greater power today. And some would argue that are looking for this all to transpire fairly quickly, that we're seeing the roots of this in the European community, you know, the EU, the European Union, because it's piecing together a lot of the states of the old Roman Empire. You know, they're not called by the same names anymore, but the same general population areas are there. And probably a few more will be added to that number. Now, whether that's in fact true or not, I don't know. I guess we'll have to wait and see how that unfolds. But it says, again, the Antichrist, he was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them. It's kind of important. Conquer here doesn't mean renounce their faith. It means to kill them or to, you know, punish them. And so he's given the power by Satan to do this. Yet God will not let him harm them in the sense that he will not allow them to lose their salvation. They may be martyred, but they won't lose their salvation. It says, and he was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. Verse 7. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the book of life belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. So when they talk about the whole world here, they're talking about the whole world that's not a believer, because they make that clear. It's all of the world, every tribe, every nation, every language, every culture, except those that have their name written in the book of life. And so, you know, we see here, again, God's providence and God's provision to protect the tribulation saints and those sealed by God. And then the prophecy goes on in verse 9 to say, he who has an ear, let him hear. And if you remember from the earlier Revelation studies, this was a common phrase when we were talking about the churches. So what's missing here is, he who has an ear, let him hear, you know, tell this to the churches. So this is not to be told to the churches. This is really for all of us to hear. This is not for the church, you know, at Ephesus, or the church at Smyrna, or the church at Laodicea. This is for all of us to hear. So he who has an ear, let him hear. Verse 10 begins something that looks like a parable. And it may be set off in your Bible. It may be set aside. It looks like a parable. And it says, let me read it in this translation, NIV. It says, if anyone is to go into captivity he will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword he will be killed. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. These are kind of mysterious verses, but what it appears to be, he's saying that in this day and time, if the forces of the Antichrist move to you, and your lot is to go to prison, then go to prison. If your lot is to be killed as a martyr, then be killed as a martyr. He said that, you know, because he says this calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. So he's equating these acts of subjugation or death in this proverb with the saints, really meaning that, you know, it's now playing out on God's time. And if you're going to be called home, then just be called home. You know, don't fight it, because you're going to be called home whether you fight it or whether you don't. You might as well go and in faithfulness, you know, take it in faithfulness and endurance. And that's kind of an interesting parallel, because, you know, in the world today, you know, we always decide what we stand up for and what we don't, what we fight and what we don't. Now, we're in a time today where we shouldn't be passive. We shouldn't be just take whatever comes. And the reason for that is not because we don't want to turn the other cheek. There's a time for that as well. But the Spirit is here, and times are moving, and people are changing, and lives can still be changed. Here the Spirit is gone. The sentence has been passed. Those who are not sealed are doomed. And so the die is cast. The winners and losers, or the sheep and the goats, as they call them, have already been separated here. And so he's saying here it's futile to fight at that point, because the die has been cast. The Lord is going to call all of the saints home. There may be a few that live through and are called to be at the final judgment time, where the second coming appears. But by and large, whatever your fate is ordained by God, and you should accept it. That's not the case today. You know, we're in a world where we can make a difference. We're in the church age. We're in the age where we're called to make a difference. We're called to speak for the Lord. We're called to witness. We're called to oppose evil. We're called to do all of that stuff, because we're still empowered with the presence of the Spirit today. Some people look at this and they become very fatalistic, and they say, well, what's the use? And the use is, this is a different time and place. This is a time when the world has been judged. The end is about to play out. We're in the final stages of the revelation, right before the second coming. And so it's kind of like the last two moves in the chess game, you know. There's no escape. The checkmate is in sight. All you do is play out your hand, or lay down your king, because you know you're done. If you ever watch chess games, you'll see when it gets to the end and the chess master who's losing understands that he's lost, they just lay the king down. They don't play the hand out. They just lay the hand. They just lay it down, because the game's over. It's just a matter of the two steps that they have to do. And so that's really the call here. It's kind of an interesting call, but it's a call that really says, if we're in that point. Now, none of us, hopefully, will be in that point. You know, we'll be part of that raptured church. We'll be called home, and so we will not be part of this judgment. But anyway, that's sort of the way it plays out. And then in verse 11, we're introduced to another character. So we've seen the dragon, who is the devil. We've seen this first beast, which is the Antichrist. Now we're going to see a second beast, which is who they call the false prophet. You'll see why as we unearth what this false prophet does. In verse 11 it says, then I saw another beast. The word another here is another of the same kind. So it's another thing that didn't look like a dragon. It kind of looked like that other beast, coming out, except for, it says, I saw another beast coming out of the earth. So he comes out of the earth this time. The symbolism for that doesn't, some people will say that means he was a Jew, because it doesn't mean he was part of the Gentile world. I don't think you really have much biblical support for that. I mean, it could be, I guess, but I don't know that you have a lot of biblical support for that. I think what it means in this sense is the sea was scary to the Jews, the earth was not. And so this beast is probably less scary to them as they look out. And you can see why. This beast has two horns like a lamb, but spoke like a dragon. So he doesn't look like this other beast, even though he's of the same kind. He looks more like a lamb, but he has two horns. Yet when he speaks like the dragon. Who's the dragon? Satan. So he speaks like Satan, but he looks less menacing than the Antichrist. And isn't that the way it happens today? You know, you always have, I don't want to relate it to politicians, but let's say in government forums, you'll have somebody that's a spokesman that has a way with words, can talk to people, can share with people, is pleasant, people like them. But they'll be parroting the words of somebody that can't come out and say those things because people don't like them. They don't like who they are. They don't like the way they talk. They don't like anything about them. So Satan here has got somebody. Satan is the great deceiver. So what he's done here is he's created this false prophet who can get out and talk to the people, can be among the people, is not scary like the Antichrist is. But yet he speaks with the voice of the dragon. He speaks like Satan himself. So his heart is with Satan, even though he doesn't look like it, and he's more familiar to the people. And so it says, he spoke like a dragon. In verse 12 it says, but he exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf. In other words, the Antichrist has given him authority. And he made the earth and his inhabitants worship the first beast. And that's why they call him a false prophet. He's a prophet that calls people to worship, not God, but to worship the Antichrist. You know, he plays up this was dead and now alive. He plays up this resurrection bit. And so he does all of the things that prophets in the Old Testament did to point people to God, that apostles in the New Testament did to point people to Christ. He does those things to point people to the Antichrist. And of course, he does them on behalf of Satan with the full power, you know, that he's been given. He made the earth and his inhabitants worship the first beast whose fatal wound had been healed. So that tells you that he plays up that resurrection, the resurrection card, so to speak. And then he says, and he performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of men. So this false prophet appears like a religious leader, prophesies on behalf of this Antichrist, calls fire down from heaven, does wondrous signs. But if you remember, when you read the Old Testament, you know, Pharaoh's soothsayers could turn sticks into snakes, could do other kinds of magic arts. So this person will have that kind of capability, but on a more grand level, a more grand scale, because he's got full power of Satan and the Antichrist given to him to perform these miracles. And his job is to pull people to worship the beast, to pull people to follow the beast or follow the Antichrist. Let me see where I am at here. Verse 13. And it performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of men. Because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. He ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. So again, this is a further counterfeiting of Christ. You know, but they don't worship the beast. They worship an image of the beast, which of course is something that God has forbidden us to do, is to worship graven images. But this graven image is kind of special. He's an image of the beast that has come back to life. And then what does it say in verse 15? Anybody want to read 13:15 for me?
He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the images of the beast to be killed.
So, any of you see some of the new stuff that's on kids' games now? I mean, you've got little toys that speak and can talk to you, and you've got, you know, these little robots that can do things, and you know, who knows where this is going to go? Some of your translation, if you got a King James Version, I want you to make a note on it, because the King James Version says he gives life to the beast. That is not accurate. The word, the Greek word for life is zoe, Z-O-E. The word used here is pneuma, or spirit. So he gives animation, he gives function to the beast. He doesn't give life to the beast. And that's a key distinction, because this, not the beast, but to this graven image. This graven image is not an alive character. It is a, I don't know, an animatron. It is something that speaks and talks and, you know, can do things. I look at it as the kind of the ultimate iRobot, you know, iBeast or whatever you want to call it. And so this beast begins to prophesy, and people of the earth are killed because of what this beast prophesies. But this beast is just an animatron. It's a graven image of, you know, what, and so this animatron is saying what the false prophet and the and Satan and what the others are asking him to say. So he's just playing out, but people follow it, and people are killed and deceived by it. It says he also forced everyone, small and great, rich, poor, free, and slave, to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead. We talk about the mark of the beast. Again, picture the seal of God. We talked about the seal of God. So the inhabitants that are the remnant on the earth, the Jews, are sealed. The believers have the mark of the Lord, so they're sealed. So Satan counterfeits this mark and makes it the mark of the beast to identify. Now, we can sort of understand today, I mean, I don't want to say this mark is a credit card, but just look at, you know, you see the commercials for Visa, where the whole world is humming along, and they all come up and they tap their credit card, and the world plays out. And then the poor guy who comes up to pay cash, you know, the world stops spinning, things fall on the floor, everything happens because he's not doing it with a credit card. And so just think of a minute, this mark of the beast, and whether that is a, you know, an embedded chip in your hand or forehead, or whether that is a UPC code, or whether it's some kind of an identity thing, that you have this giant account in the sky, and if you don't have this thing, you can't buy anything, you can't sell anything, you can't get food, you can't get water, you can't get gas, you can't get clothes. All of the things that we use in the world to live by, we can't get anymore from a government source. So, I mean, the Christians, I'm sure, at this point begin bartering and trading and underground markets and all kinds of things, like in the old days where people, you know, they'd go to the farmer and they'd trade wool for food, or they'd trade meat for food, or they'd trade something else. And so, you know, you can see a barter system developing because the world commerce has shut out everybody. And it's like an embargo to shut us out, to make us worship the beast, to force us into the system. It says no one could buy or sell anything unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name. Now, we'll read the last sentence in a second, but if you think about it for a minute, do any of you do business over a telephone where you've got a password to key in? Don't you all love that? Well, if you have a password, or it says key in your last name, well, you can't key in your last name with the numbers, but what you can key in is the numbers that are on the keypad. So if you've got a J, K, or L, and that's number 6, then you key in a 6 for J, K, or L, right? Well, in the same way, the Hebrew language and the Greek language, they use symbolisms like the letter alpha, which is the first letter in the Greek language, stood for the number 1. The letter omega stood for, I think, 24. I think there's 24 letters in the Greek alphabet. In the same way, A would stand for 1 and Z would stand for 26 in our alphabet. So in the same way, you could say, okay, I'm going to put the name Fred down, and I'm going to say, okay, Fred is number whatever it is, you know, R, E, D, and I could add those numbers up, and I could come to a number. Well, that's what people used to do to sign things. And we do them today as passcodes and ciphers. You know, when if you ever read the book Key to Rebecca, which is an old-time spy novel, but Rebecca was a book. And on, you know, they would give you a page number and then a letter number and a line. And so they would write codes in letters and lines. And that would indicate you'd go to the book and look up the word. And that would be your translation of it. So it's been used for generations for ciphers and codes. And then we come to verse 18 here, which is kind of the verse of endless speculation. And it says, this calls for wisdom. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast. For it is a man's number. His number is 666. And so we see this, and the symbolism is kind of this, okay? Seven is a complete number in the history of the Jews. Seven was a number of completeness. Seven times seven, the number 49 was a kind of a double number of completion. Six was the number of a man because it was close to being complete, but not really complete. So we also know that If you ever look at the New Testament, you'll see things like, in the King James, you'll see, verily, verily, verily. Well, what that really means is, I'm telling you verily three times because I want to emphasize this point. So the 666 really says, this person was a man, a real live flesh and blood man. But if you take it literally, it also means his name adds up to 666. And, you know, people have said, well, if you take Hitler and add up the numbers, it comes to 666. And so there may be a lot of coincidences, and I suppose if you were mathematically oriented, you could figure out the probability of a number coming to 666. And, you know, some people add them, some people multiply them. You know, some people say, well, if you add 100 to each one of these things, it becomes 666. So people throughout the years have come up with endless speculation on who this is. But I believe that when it's time for us to know, God will reveal it to us. And it'll be obvious to us, those that understand and are looking for this. But today, that person may be alive, that person may not be alive. We see the progression of the Antichrist will be to come up politically, become a head of one of these 10-nation confederacies, and then become the head that people worship and follow. So there's a political progression. This person may be alive today, may not be alive today. I don't have any idea. I mean, the end could be tomorrow, or could be 100 years from now. I don't have anybody idea, and I don't think anybody else does either. Although you can buy plenty of books that say it's going to be, you know, December 15th on this year, you know. And, of course, December 16th comes. Oh, I've got an error in my math. Let me redo it real quick, you know. Nobody really knows for sure. But it's kind of an interesting speculation, and all of the symbols we have today, you know, we talk about the false prophet, and you can read the Left Behind series, and you can see the false prophet, and they act out some of the things that the false prophet could have done. I mean, may not have done, but could have done, because he falls into that role, and you can see the Antichrist, and, you know, you can see kind of a modern author's view of what a real person may look like. And those are interesting reading if you've never read them. Don't take them as biblical scripture because they're not. They're just an interpretation, just to give us some life to these visions and see what they might, how they might play out. But they're pretty interesting. So we're going to stop there because I know it's getting close to time. Anybody have any questions or anything about what we've looked at so far?
In verse 12.
Yes.
You were talking about the other beast.
Yes.
And it says his fatal wound had been healed. What did you say that
one? He's talking there not about the false prophet, but about the Antichrist. And the Antichrist is supposed to survive a fatal wound, and that's what's going to make everybody in awe and follow him and be worshipped. The false prophet simply points that out and gets everybody to worship him because, you know, he's obviously of God because he was dead and now he's alive and he's got all this power. He's calling fire down from heaven. He's doing all this kind of stuff. So that's to represent the king of one of these countries that suffers a fatal wound or a mortal wound, let's say, and is not killed, actually comes back to life. And so, you know, commentators attribute that characteristic to the Antichrist, and that's the one that's going to survive and be the one that's worshipped because of the false prophet and what the false prophet does, you know, later. So that's to represent one of the kings of the New Roman Empire, the one that will be elevated to be the Antichrist.
in modern medicine, and a lot of deceitful lies can blow it out of proportion so that everybody believes that it.
Well, and you know, today, if somebody has brain surgery, they cool the body. They cool the body way down because they don't want all the blood pumping, and they want the body to be at rest when they go in. They don't want trauma to happen. And so, I mean, the medical miracles we have today, you know, 100 years ago would look like sorcery, would look like, you know, but today we accept them as understanding the physiology of the human body and being able to deal with it. Well, who knows what we'll be able to do at this time. But that's different from the God capability of taking something that's inanimate, something that's dead, something that has no life, and bringing it back to life. You know, that's a different function. You know, we can start a heart from somebody whose heart has stopped. But they're not clinically dead when that happens. When they're clinically dead and their brain has stopped and their lungs have stopped and they've, you know, then bringing them back to life is not something that we do or we can do. So it's kind of a, you know, I don't know. It's all mystical, and we've got to sort of take it as that and just take it as the bigger picture that we look at of what God's trying to tell us. But good points. Any other comments or questions?
Jim, one thing, this was some time back, but someone else was teaching Revelation, and they indicated that the baby that was born was the church. Have you ever?
Yeah, I've heard that. There's people, you can find, I don't care where you look, you can find a different interpretation of all of these symbols, because of some people believe all of this played out in the Roman times, and there is no, this is not a future view. But they refer to this person as a man or as a person and as a man-child as opposed to an organization. So I don't think most of your modern interpreters see it as anything but Christ. But there are people that believe that. You know, there are people that believe that, you know, Caligula was the Antichrist, or Nero, because if you take Nero and multiply him instead of add him together, it comes up to 666. But I don't think, you know, this whole view of the end times we haven't seen yet, because A, the church is still here. You know, we haven't seen all of the plagues that he's talked about. Since this happens in the middle of the tribulation, I don't think you can really say, you know, with a history as a perspective, that we've all this stuff has passed. But there's a million interpretations of these things. I'm sort of giving you what I think based on what I read and how I interpret it, but you're certainly free to think, interpret however you want to do it, however the Lord leads you to do that, because I don't know whether I'm right or not. I just, I'll tell you what I think, and then you can make up your own mind. So I won't try to sway you one way or the other. Any other thoughts? All right, let's have a, yeah.
When I was in China, I talked to Samuel Lam. He had been in prison for 23 years in China, and because very few people have a Bible, they were very intent, those who did, on these numbers, almost to the point of being sacrilegious. And that's all they talk about, are the numbers. And it was very interesting to sit there and listen to him, because he pulled out every number in the book and tried to relate it to the Lord's coming. And I think that's a big mistake.
Well, I think it is too. I think it's a, you know, Jim talks about, you know, millennialism being pre, post, or pan. And pan-millennialism is not a real word, but it means it's going to pan out the way God wants it to. And I think that's really, regardless of what we think, it's going to play out the way God has it, and we just got to accept it. And I know today, I think you were telling us, you or Bob One, that if you go to China, they don't want you to, Revelation can't be a part of anything you read or study there, because they don't want Revelation anywhere near China because of all the superstitions and the stuff that they do. Kind of interesting.